Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. This week's program with your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra couldn't be much simpler. Just two pieces will be played, Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition and Beethoven's Colossal Piano Concerto No. 5, The Emperor. Here to take us through them are your RPO Music Director, Ward Stair, and this week's soloist and Rochester favorite, Olga Kern. Olga, welcome back into our
Thank you. It's so great to be back.
Welcome to you as well, Ward.
Nice to see you, as always.
So it's a pretty simple program, but you've thrown in a few curveballs into it. So let's start with the very first piece, Pictures at an Exhibition by Mussorgsky. A little background on this, please.
Sure. It's actually a very interesting story. The piece began its life as a work for solo piano, and it was inspired by literally Pictures at an Exposition by Victor Hartmann, was the artist who was on display. And there's a story. Mussorgsky and Hartmann were very good friends. Hartmann was kind of a Renaissance man. He was a great architect, a great visual artist, just a really great figure in the cultural life at the time there in Russia. And he died very suddenly. He wasn't even 40 years old, I don't think, and it really was a shock to the whole artistic community there, and Mussorgsky, being a close friend, was devastated, really. And so a few people got together and had this idea to exhibit I think over 400 works of Hartmann's in this grand exposition. And so the show was put on, and it was open, I'm not sure for how long, but Mussorgsky went and was admiring all this work and remembering his great friend. Mussorgsky contributed, I think, two works that he personally owned, which Hartmann had given to him, to the whole exposition. As he was walking around Mussorgsky and looking at all this amazing work that his dearly departed friend had done, he got the inspiration to write a piece of music in tribute to the man, the artist, and this event which had happened. And so we had Pictures in an Exhibition. It wasn't really well received right off the bat. Some people thought it was kind of a crazy idea, and they weren't sure, and Mussorgsky thought maybe he went too far, and so it actually wasn't published until after Mussorgsky's death, and Rimsky-Korsakov was the one who said this needs to be published and needs to be in the repertoire.
Now, this started off as a piano piece, and Olga, one of the things that you do best, I think, of all people, is to play Russian music, so I'm going to make a guess here that you have played Pictures at an Exhibition.
Yes, I did. I did, and it's a very special piece, of course, for each pianist, because it's an incredible piece of music, and it's just really a painting. Each of the pieces is a painting, and just to paint this on the piano the right way, colorful way, it's not so easy, and it's a really a great one of my favorite pieces.
It strikes me as a very difficult piece for piano because of the pacing as well. You have light, heavy, fast, slow.
Yes, and this is what I love. I love all the contrasts always because piano can make really a great sound of an orchestra if you know how to do it. So this piece is definitely shows piano as a really grand instrument.
In previous years, you and I have discussed the piano writing of Tchaikovsky, the piano writing of Rachmaninoff. Tell me about the piano writing of Mussorgsky.
It's totally different, of course, from both Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff. It was so modern that time, I think, that this is why probably it was not really received that well at the beginning, because there is so much things which are not, well understood by the ear, especially that time. And it's actually very contemporary even by now, because there are so many dissonance and things how he wrote it, and the way of the chords and octaves and everything how he wrote it for the piano. It's very unusual, I would say.
Now, just before we started this interview, you were showing this great photograph of a Pictures piano.
Yes, that is a Steinway made, very special, a unique piano. It's just the one of the kind. And it's called Pictures and Exhibitions. And it's, of course, inspired by Mussorgsky's piece. And it has a lot of paintings on it. And it's a beautiful, beautiful form of the piano. And legs have this very special, every leg has a special meaning also there, as a baba yaga, and then another as a cloak. And then it's just a gorgeous, just a piece of art. And it also sounds great. So I was in Beijing in the summer, and I saw the piano and I played on it. So it was just really wonderful.
Did you actually play Pictures on Pictures?
Of course.
You had to. So we take this complex piano music that Olga was describing, and it gets turned into this orchestral thing. When did that start happening?
Well, it wasn't until several years after the piece was published as a piano work that someone got the idea to expand it and make it a full orchestra piece, and I believe the first one to do that was Tushmalov, and he, you know, expanded the whole thing, orchestrated every movement, and then a couple other people did it. Sir Henry Wood did it in England around, I think, 1915-ish, and then Serge Koussevitzky, the great conductor, commissioned Maurice Ravel, the master composer and master orchestrator, to do his own orchestration of Pictures at an Exhibition, and of course it was a masterpiece and very popular right from the beginning, and that has sort of become the standard Pictures that everyone is familiar with, Ravel's.
It's interesting because and it's been orchestrated since Ravel as well, but why is it about Ravel that sort of captured the prize?
Well, I think it's just, first of all, it's so well done. I mean, Ravel was perhaps the greatest, or certainly one of the greatest orchestrators of all time. It began with Rimsky-Korsakov, actually, in Russia. But Ravel definitely took it to the next level. And he himself said, Ravel said, that out of the entire compositional process, orchestration was always when he had the most fun. He loved it. And you can tell all of his pieces are just so rich in color and texture and atmosphere, and just what he could do, his imagination and his skill as a composer is just really hard to beat. So it's no surprise that he just knocked it out of the park when he did his own Pictures, and it's become a standard in orchestral repertoire all over the world.
So there are, what, 9 different versions of this?
Well, this week you will hear in our performance 9 different composers' realizations of various movements. But there's actually, the rabbit hole goes much deeper than that if you want to take the time. I can't take credit for this concept, by the way, making the compendium and performing it that way. It was an idea that that Leonard Slatkin had, the great American conductor. He started doing it in the late 80s, and he's recorded it. He's performed various versions all over the world, really. And so I'm a big fan of Leonard and his work, and he's been a great mentor to me. And I called him up a couple years ago and said, you know, I really love your arrangement, your idea of the different arrangements and Pictures, and I'd love to do it with my orchestra in Rochester. Do you mind? And he said, no, that'd be great. So he sent us his parts, and I'm conducting from his score and all that. So it's really nice. I'm very grateful to Leonard for sharing this project with us here in Rochester.
In fact, isn't the first promenade Leonard's?
Well, it's not Leonard Slatkin's. Leonard, Lawrence Leonard, is the composer of the first promenade. But Leonard himself, Leonard Slatkin, looked at over 20 different orchestrations of various movements when he was deciding which movements to put in his compendium. And he's revised that since as well. What we're performing this week is one of, I think, 3 versions that he himself does in various places. And there's even more. If you want something fun to do on a Saturday night and you're not busy with something else, go on YouTube and just look up various arrangements of Pictures. And you'll get hits for everything from small chamber ensemble, solo guitar, wind ensemble, band, lots of orchestra arrangements. I counted, not on YouTube, but in other research I did, at least 80 different versions that exist. So this is something that's been done quite often, a lot more than most people realize.
All right, so now we have this version. It's mm-hmm. locked and loaded in our heads. We love this version.
Ravel's version.
You bet.
Right.
Now we're going to sit down and we're going to hear what? Mm-hmm. How different? What are some of the differences that are going to pop up where people will really say, well, that's not what I remember?
Well, right off the bat, the very first promenade, which famously begins with the solo trumpet, sort of heralding the beginning of this great work and this great event, it's not for solo trumpet at all. It starts, there is a trumpet in the beginning, there are also horns, and there are tubular bells, chimes, which ring out, and Lawrence Leonard says in the score, let it ring, and it gives you a completely different mood and atmosphere. It feels as though you're out in a public square somewhere, and you hear the chiming of the bells at the church or the town hall sort of announcing the beginning of this great event, and they ring and you get the atmosphere, and the orchestra is a lot more sort of fanfare-ish and marcato throughout that first movement, so it's got more of a kind of stately feel to it rather than the more noble, I guess, mood that Ravel put in his first movement, his first promenade.
Other movements that we're going to find a distinct, huge difference in?
Oh, yeah. Well, each one actually has a lot of great differences.
Does Ravel show up at all?
Well, yes. So we have 9 different composers, and Ravel is one of them. So talk about value on the dollar this week. I mean, you come to this concert, not only do you get to hear the great Olga Kern and Beethoven's masterpiece, Fifth Concerto, you get to hear a piece on the second half that includes the ideas of 9 great artists and 10, if you count Mussorgsky himself, all in one piece. So it's really, it's a fascinating journey, and it's a lot of fun to hear the differences and see them and hear them performed live.
I'm curious to find out which of the Ravels Mr. Slatkin decided to keep in this suite.
Well, let me tell you, I can go through them quickly. So Gnomus, which is the second movement, it's this little troll gnome kind of character with crooked legs who walks unevenly and is kind of, you know, mysterious and a little bit grotesque. That is by Ashkenazi. Ashkenazi did his own arrangement as well. And you'll find in the Ashkenazi version that it's similar in terms of the music, I should say, incidentally, is unchanged theoretically. I mean, the notes, there are a couple places where there are actually different notes thrown in, and that's due to the discrepancies in some of the arrangements that came for the piano version. So Ashkenazi added more percussion, some more exaggerated utterances from the brass and things, so it makes Gnomus just a little bit more deformed and a little more awkward and jagged than what Ravel gives us. There's also very sort of mysterious, creepy lines that he puts in the string basses where they're playing these chromatic lines that go up and down, very sort of shadowy and fast, too. Ravel puts beautiful string glisses in as well, but they're slower, so it just it gives us more of the sort of impish mood in the Gnomus than Ravel. Then the second promenade, which is the third movement, is by Caillé, and that's similar again, but the horn starts it in the Ravel, and in this version it's a fuller orchestration. And the strings play one chorus, dolce, and for variety the woodwinds join in, so there's more color in this promenade with Caillé. Then for the Old Castle, the famous saxophone solo, this is by Gorchakov, one of the other great early orchestrators of this work. And the picture itself was, you know, this ancient Italian castle. And Hartmann was in the habit, in his architectural drawings particularly, of putting figures in people, you know, in the paintings for scale. At first, that was the functional reason for it, but it was also an artistic thing, too. And so the image in this picture of the old castle is that there's a troubadour outside sort of serenading. I don't know, is there someone in there he's serenading, or is it more of a haunted memory? And with the saxophone that Ravel chose, it's got a very provocative sound about it, but it's very present as well. You know, it's very... it's mournful, but it's a little bit, you know, saxophone is kind of more of an in-your-face instrument. Well, what Gorchakov did is he makes it for muted trumpet, which gives you a sense of great distance, and I think also it brings you back more in time. I think it's more suggestive that the troubadour, the troubadour might not even be there. It might be the memory of the troubadour or what happened hundreds of years ago at this ancient castle. It's really quite stunning.
Oh, sax players are going to be so sad.
I know. All the sax players aren't going to hear the standard solo. The trumpet players are going to say, why didn't the trumpet get to start it off? But you have to open your mind because these are also great ideas. The next promenade, which is a much shorter walk, is by Leonardi. And this one is a little bit different because it's a little more dramatic. It's fuller in the brass. The whole promenade, this one, is only 8 bars long. But Leonardi expanded the brass, and so there's a more dramatic diminuendo at the very end of it, which leads us into the scene of the children playing in the gardens by the Louvre, and that's also by Leonardi. And this one has a saxophone, but it's not an alto saxophone, it's a soprano saxophone. And so, you know, this is the be-dum, be-dum. And the images of these kids kind of taunting each other and fighting, quarreling, you know, as they're after school or whatever. And so the soprano sax gives it a little bit more of an edge to it, you know, so it's kind of a little more complainy than Ravel. Ravel was a little more reserved, I guess, in his depiction of these children.
Apparently these children are ruder than Ravel's children.
Exactly. Leonardi's children were ruder. and then, after that, we come to one of the biggest differences, which is Biedlo, the ox cart, a very famous tuba solo in Maurice Ravel's version. This is an interesting movement because in one of the early piano arrangements, it starts forte. So the ox cart is right there, front and center. And Ravel didn't do that. Ravel started it piano, but the ox is right there, the tuba, you know, played by the tuba, right from the beginning. But it's just sort of an image of distance, and then as the cart approaches, there's a big crescendo, and then the cart goes away. Well, the movement we're doing this week is by Sir Henry Wood, and he decides to take that even further, although his version actually came before Ravel's. But Henry Wood adds a few bars in the beginning of this this ostinato, so you just get the bum, bim, bum, bim, bum, bim, bum, bim, for 4 bars before you hear any melody. And it's not in the tuba, it's in the French horns at the beginning. But then it grows and builds, and the orchestration is even fuller than what Ravel wrote. And he added this wonderful instrument called the camel bells, which is, it's like, if you imagine a cowbell, you know, cows or the Amglock, the, you know, the things in Mahler, you know, you hear the cowbells. But this is a camel bell, which is like a cowbell on steroids. And so we, unfortunately, we don't own a camel bell. So we've been playing around trying to see if we can get the closest approximation, you know, of this sound. But you get this huge, you know, cart, this enormous ox, muscular ox coming down. And then at the climax, you hear the rattling of the bell as he walks by. And it's just, it's over the top. It's great. So, you know, that's a big difference. You'll notice a big difference from what you're accustomed to in the Ravel. Then we go on to another promenade. This is also by Caillé. It's a little bit calmer. There's never a forte dynamic as there is in the Ravel, I believe. So it's a little bit more, it's a great contrast. I mean, the way Leonard Slatkin selected these, I think, is brilliant because after you get this over-the-top Biedlo, you get a very intimate promenade to contrast.
And I really can hear because that was very much the way English composers were writing at that time with that. They liked that exotic sound and that big sound. Mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm. You know, that was, I'm looking forward to that one.
Yeah. Then the Unhatched Chicks, the ballet of the chicks as they hatch. You know, it was actually originally a drawing, I think, for a set design of a ballet. And the scene was going to have, you know, chicks coming out of the eggs and running all around. So it's kind of frantic, and, you know, there's a lot of cheep, 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 cheep kind of going everywhere. And this is also by Caillé, so it's a little bit more rambunctious, a little more over the top. There's more percussion, there's more brass, there's a little wood block, you know, going, you know, clucking along with the woodwinds and the trumpets. It's a lot of fun. I like that movement. it's rambunctious for sure. Then we have another promenade, which actually Ravel omitted. There's one promenade that Ravel did not include in his version, and so it's restored here. That's also by Caillé. And then we go to the two Jews, the rich and the poor, which was another famous excerpt The trumpet plays it, and that's in the Ravel. But this one is by Gorchakov, and he gives it again to the saxophone. So it's the soprano saxophone.
Sax players are feeling really, really much better now.
Yeah, they should be vindicated because they don't get to play the Old Castle, but they get to show off, you know,
elsewhere.
And Doug Prosser, our principal trumpetist, you know, he's probably breathed a sigh of relief, so he didn't have to play that excerpt. But it's similar, actually, the first part of it to what we're used to in Ravel, with the first painting, you know, the ba-dum, ba-dum, that's all pretty much the same. It's more the second part that's different with the soprano saxophone. Then from there, also one important thing that I just remembered after the second painting, the poor Jew, and then you hear the soprano sax doing it. The last bars, the note is different. Instead of ba-dee-da-dum, it's ba-dee-da-dum, which comes from another earlier version. So if you notice that, it's not a mistake. That's actually intentional. So that's one example where the note itself is actually a little bit different. Then we go to the marketplace, and this is Tushmalov. The women haggling with the vendors and, you know, fighting amongst themselves over products and things like that. This is a little bit different from the Ravel in that the woodwind section does most of the haggling and bickering. The strings do less of it. In Ravel's, it kind of gets shared more evenly, but it's mostly the woodwinds doing it.
Which actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I love it. And then we come to the Catacombs, which is an arrangement by Leopold Stokowski, who did his own. And
Stokowski, yeah. So known for his subtlety.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, I mean, we know his Toccata and Fugue, his Bach arrangements, things like that. Well, if you take time to look up a recording of his pictures, it is out there. It's way over the top. But, I mean, so was Stokowski, and I love it. It's like the perfect kind of zany and crazy. So the catacombs are more profound. They're deeper. There's more brass. It's stretched out a little bit more, so it's just very weighty, and you know, it's very monumental, kind of the catacombs. You just get a feeling like they expanded the ceiling on the catacombs or something with Stokowski's version. Then we go back to another version by Henry Wood of the second part of the catacombs, the Cum Mortuis, which is, it's beautiful. This Mussorgsky wrote that in the picture for the catacombs, you know, there's a guy with a lantern going around looking at all the skulls, and this, the music kind of changes at this point, because previous to this movement, or to the catacombs really, we get the sense that we're the observer at the exhibition looking at the paintings, and then at this point he almost gets sucked in to the drama himself, and he wrote on the manuscript, I believe, that Hartmann, he saw the ghost of Hartmann leading him around, and he approached the skulls, and as he approached them, he invoked their energy, and they began to glow. So it's this wonderful image. It's eerie and haunting, and Henry Wood does it very subtly with three solo violas in the beginning. It's gorgeous the way it just sort of lingers in that dim light by those glowing skulls. And then there's more intimate writing for the English horn, two horns, two French horns, and one English horn later. And then the whole piece just kind of takes you to this mystical, you know, world where time's stopped and you don't really know where you are. Then we're rudely interrupted by Baba Yaga. And this is where Ravel comes in. So the last two movements are by Maurice Ravel. We couldn't do pictures without having a little bit of Ravel, of course. And Baba Yaga is, of course, the witch who lived in, it's a like a legend, right, in Russian folklore culture, I think.
Yes. This is a fairy tale. Was this one that your parents?
And the Baba Yaga was always the scary one.
She's gonna come
one.
Get you
of
if you
course,
don't.
Of course, if
don't
you're
do
bad,
your
exactly.
Your bed,
if you're
yeah.
bad.
Did your parents invoke the
ugly,
Baba Yaga
crazy
with you?
Witch. Yeah, I was like always afraid, always.
Yeah.
It's a scary, scary personage. Yeah.
And it's a great depiction musically. I mean, it's got this really tremendous driving force. Ravel writes, you know, feroce in the beginning, so it's ferocious. It's propelling forward. And then, of course, we arrive at the Great Gate, and that's also Ravel. which is, it was a painting that Hartmann did for the design of a gate that was supposed to be built, never was, unfortunately, but it's very grandiose, and just like the music would suggest, it's a thrilling climax to a very interesting journey.
So you have actually saved the best for last in many ways. Everybody else will be great, but in the one that we love and we know.
Well, save the most familiar for last. I mean, in a way, you can. It's subjective. You can say what you like better. But this concert, this concept is not about saying one is better than the other. It's really about showing a multitude of different ideas and approaches. And I think, you know, as a conductor, with orchestras, orchestration is one thing that fascinates me, and I love it, you know, and trying to bring out different colors and different things. And I think that's a lot of what goes into being a great composer. And so as musicians, we need to remember that we need to always have an open mind and think there's so many different ways to approach a phrase or a piece, and this is a perfect example of that.
And you and I have discussed on any number of times the idea that something is a real familiar piece and you play it over and over and over again, and that search for something new. So this is a very different way of doing that.
Right.
It's a familiar
right.
piece. I actually, one of the members of the orchestra said it's like starting all over again to play this because it's not anything that they've ever done before.
Right. Right. And it's good for us. It's good for us. And I think it's great for the audience, too.
I think it's going to be a great gift. And I'm looking forward to it. Now, the other half of the program is one that is also very familiar. It's The Emperor by Beethoven. This is extraordinary. His big last piece. He never played this, right, Olga?
No. And it's such a monumental, great concerto.
You are known for your Russian interpretations. Is the language of Beethoven very different than the language of a Russian composer?
Of course it's different, but, you know, all Russian school came from Beethoven, actually. If you think about the chain which comes from Beethoven, goes to Liszt, and then Czerny, and then all other great Russian pianist composers, for example, Alexander Zelotsky, who was a cousin of Rachmaninoff, who studied abroad and studied with Czerny, and then came to Moscow, and then he had great students, and you know, including you know, professors who got the best pianists and the best musicians in Russia, not only in Moscow Conservatory, but also in St. Petersburg Conservatory. So the Russian school actually comes from that genius as Beethoven. So I think as all pianists, I can say that Beethoven was such an incredible composer for piano. And it's we are just so fortunate that he wrote so many great pieces for piano, and including all his concerti. I wish I would, you know, my dream, and I think it will be very soon. It will come alive that I'll play all of them, all five. I play number one, three, and five at the moment. So I just have a little time to like. Yes, exactly. We'll do that. it's an incredible piece of music, and this concerto has, I think, everything. It's also a romantic piece in the way. It's just to die for. The second movement is kind of music from heaven for me. And there is a six bars place in the second movement, which he writes. It's so beautiful that even me as a performer, my heart is just beating so much faster, and it never comes back. It's after the first, part of a piano, after a couple of bars of the beginning, after the orchestra played, that piano comes. And then after that, before the orchestra comes back and the return to that, just a few bars of the orchestra, there is this six bars of that incredible music, which it's just hard to describe What can be even more beautiful than that? And he just doesn't want to show it again. So it just only one time appears there, and
I guess once,
it's just pure heaven.
Once was enough, I guess.
I think so.
That movement is also very interesting to me because it's unlike many of the middle movements, which are very chamber music-like, this one feels really full-on orchestral.
Mm-hmm.
This one doesn't have that chamber music sort of feel to it. It really is round and big, but yet really small at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's both. I wouldn't say it's not still chamber music. I mean, it's very intimate, actually, the way we phrase together in this movement. But the whole concerto really is fascinating and I think very important in the repertoire because it sort of, and Olga just alluded to this, it sort of opened up the door to the great romantic concertos that came after it. And if you look at it, you know, Beethoven, and you mentioned, Julia, that Beethoven did not perform this because at that point he was too deaf to perform it himself. He performed all his other concerti at one time or another. And I think it's, I mean, I don't, of course, want to speak for Beethoven, but I think it's reasonable to assume that, or to guess that he was looking, okay, I'm not going to be able to do this anymore because, you know, if you look at Mozart piano concertos and the sort of high classical model of piano concertos, it was a vehicle for the soloist, for the virtuoso. There were cadenzas which were improvised. Beethoven doesn't give a proper cadenza in this concerto.
Not in this concerto, no.
And he doesn't, so he doesn't give any wiggle room there. He maintains all the control over it, and he knew that he wasn't going to be able to perform it. So he thought, okay, what direction is this concerto model going to go in for me? And it ended up being for everyone, you know, opening up. And so that's why it's so much, it's really symphonic. The whole thing's like a symphony.
Exactly. This is, like even the second movement, there is no solo piano, really. It's always blended with the orchestra. And actually, I wanted to say that it is, in my interpretation, I really wanted to have it like more intimate and more chamber music in this movement because it is, I think, how he put the piano and the orchestra together in this movement particularly. It's just so great and so close. It's not a big kind of show, that he wanted to show that the piano is the, you know, most important here. No, it's everything is very important, and the flute and all other instruments. And we are just kind of passing that melody from one to another. And it's just so it's in another world. This movement is really another world, and it's one of my favorite movements, I must say, because there is never a conversation between piano and, like in a Beethoven Fourth, for example. It's always together.
Mm-hmm.
We're always together, except the beginning of the second movement is only orchestra. But I think it's important that orchestra starts. So it's he gives here a much bigger meaning of the orchestra here.
This is the start of this is also a little different. So many of the big romantic concertos have this big orchestral thing and then the sweeping entrance of the pianist. This gets reversed in this. We start off with the piano and the orchestra, and then the pianist, you will actually just step back for a little bit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... I mean, it's a very, if you imagine listening to this, the very first performance or when it was first, you know, performed and created, I mean, wow, what an idea. You know, it's kind of like the Third Symphony where there's really no introduction, just bang, here we go, we're off and running. And he gives you this robust, you know, chord that's just wonderful and then flourishes in the piano. And you think, wait a minute, is it time for the cadenza? What's going on? And then, no, it's not a cadenza. Oh, bang, hit him again with this chord. It's so bold and it's so, it just jars you, makes you sit up and pay attention. It's wonderful.
And how he makes a piano right away sound big.
Mm-hmm.
As an emperor, instrument, because that arpeggios from bottom of the piano till the really top, it just makes sound so big and so grand and monumental. So it's really incredible.
But it's interesting that the emperor title was not given to the piece by Beethoven.
No.
And actually,
I think
he, when it first came out, he was probably rolling over, spinning in his grave, because we all know the story about the Third Symphony and how he, you know, violently scratched out Napoleon.
Exactly.
So he wasn't too fond of emperors. And
For me, you know, this, what I said, emperor, it's just meaning that the pianist emperor here.
Right.
For me, that is the most important thing.
Right. And I actually read somewhere, I forget who it was attributed to, but someone early on, you know, said, this is the emperor of piano concertos.
Exactly.
And that's how it, that's
that
how
is
it got.
How I
yeah.
feel it, yes. It,
yes, yes. So.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Kids would say, whatevs. So I think to me, one of the real hallmarks of this is that moment, you know where I'm going with this, where the second movement slides into the third.
Oh, it's just, it's amazing.
Amazing.
I mean, it's
amazing.
Just, it's this. It's not even, to call it sleight of hand or anything like that is not to do it justice. It's just, it's magical. The way he eases you out of that magical world that Olga was talking about into the finale, which is just
two bars. Just two bars.
But it's so, it's amazing what he does.
It is. It's like a movie kind of, you know, like movie scene.
Yeah, you pan out
exactly.
and then it opens
and
up and then boom! Yeah. And then
you go. Sudden, complete different character.
Oh.
What is it like being in the middle of that movie?
You know, I always feel like I'm in a different world when I play. So I am in a different world. And of course, to have, with you on stage, someone who really understands exactly what you are doing, I think it's all bringing the whole composition different level. So I'm happy it really... I think together we really make sound it special, at least for me. I feel it this way.
I agree. No, I have to say it's not the experience for me with every soloist that I work with that I feel like there's such a kindred spirit. And we've performed together a couple times now, and it's just such a treat this week. And we rehearsed
it's
this
great.
Morning, and it was awesome. Felt like we've been doing it for
a
long time,
exactly.
Which is what you want.
So
it's just great.
Yeah.
I also have to add, by the way, in that transition between the second and the third, that the starring role is given to a bassoon. And I think that was very generous of Beethoven to give the bassoon that note, you know.
He liked to spread the wealth. But, I mean, he thins out the texture to a point where it's just two bassoons in an octave. And then it gets passed to the horns, who are also in an octave. So it's this moment of great suspense and kind of, time stops, but he doesn't push you, you know, kick you out of the seat, you know, too abruptly. Then there's this,
just one chord on the piano. It's just the E flat major. That's it. It's like there is nothing else.
And then there's one little pizzicato in the strings, which then gives Olga the little nudge to sort of suggest the theme that's going to emerge in the third movement. And then there's one more little pizz. It's so delicate. It's fragile still. It's tender. And then all of a sudden, you get to a point where, okay, you're sort of wound up and ready, and then, boom, the door opens. It's just, it's magic.
And it was written at a terrible time.
Yes, it was. Vienna was being shelled. Beethoven was huddled in basements with other people trying to stay safe, and his hearing was starting to go, and it was just, it was awful, and it's amazing that he was able to write such a beautiful, life-affirming piece in the midst of all that.
Which was beloved from note one.
Mm-hmm.
This was a hit from note one. Nobody had any problem with this one, even though he made all those changes. And he did all of those revolutionary things to the art form. Nobody got their back up over this one.
Well, they were right.
Yes.
Yes, they were. Yes, they were. You know, you, I believe it is, said that it's like hearing Beethoven's voice.
I think so. Yeah, especially the second movement.
Yes.
It's just so...
For sure.
So amazing.
Yeah.
So
it is,
amazing.
It is.
So what is Beethoven's voice telling us in this concerto, Olga?
I think, you know, I must say that it's a happy piece in general.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the second movement is, it's not, there is no, nothing like what we would experience with Beethoven and his other compositions. Mm-hmm. It's a really extraordinary piece, and it's just really, it's E flat major, and it's really a triumph of music. It's really a celebration of something extraordinary, and the extraordinary piano and the orchestra, and I think it's just such a masterpiece. I can't say anything more than that, because it is a celebration of music from the beginning till the end, and with so many different colors so many different feelings. But in general, it's all happy feelings. And this is why we love this concerto so much.
Mm-hmm. He managed to rise above in the time of war.
Exactly.
Well, music was really his one refuge throughout his life. I mean, he had so much trouble in his personal life, even in his professional life, with colleagues and things mm-hmm. like that. But the one thing he could always count on was his music. And it's the kind of piece that no matter what kind of mood you're in, you will leave the concert hall or, finish your listening experience feeling refreshed and positive.
Yes.
And happy.
Yes.
And exuberant.
Yes.
It's just one of the, and it never gets old. That's one mm-hmm. of the things I love about pieces like this and so many with Beethoven. The communication is so pure and honest and direct.
Exactly.
And profound. And it always, it's always great that you have that experience every single time.
Exactly. And, when I play it, I play it many times. I always find something new in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's so
mm-hmm.
many details you can just still do. And this is incredible because we have so many different interpretations of this piece. And a lot of pianists is one of the favorite, concerto to perform. And still, it's so fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And every time it's fresh.
We look forward to rising above with both of you this weekend with the RPO. Thank you very much, Olga Curran, for being here.
Thank you.
And Ward Stair, always welcome back, of course. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening into this podcast. If you'd like information about the Rochester Philharmonic season, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.